books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and in today's last visit to Scotland's book town for this year, we're getting witchy. We're talking to some Wigtown locals, and we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Coming up on today's show, Annalise Avery tells us all about her new series, The Witcherlies, and gives us some great book recommendations in Books of My Life. We'll get some poetry from Wigtown's resident storyteller, Renita Boyle, talk to listener Charlotte Benny about how the festival is for accessibility, and as always, we'll find some brand new audiobooks out now and also in the RNIB library. All coming up on today's Read On. Annalise Avery is the author of books such as The Night Silver Promise, Witch Spark and The Immortal Games. She was at Wigtown though to talk about her new series, The Witcherlies, in which you can expect family secrets, generational curses, forbidden romance, gorgeous ball gowns, bribery, extortion, trespass, magic and kissing. Lots of kissing. The audio version of The Witcherlies Book 1 is read by Imogen Wilde.
Great Aunt Antoinette was dead, but the curse she had carried was very much alive. Not that I knew this as I stood in the gardens of Hemlock Square awaiting the arrival of my magic. I had just turned 17, and the Thunder Moon was as full and blinding as my blissful ignorance. I should have been terrified, but instead I was excited. And expectant. We Witcherlies are powerful witches with a line that stretches back to the first age of magic. I was sure that I would be all a Witcherly witch should be. My magic rose in me, lifting me into the air. The power strummed through me and I felt more alive than ever, connected to the world and everything in it. When the pain started, I thought it was part of the magic, even when I was screaming up to the stars. I did not know that Great Aunt Antoinette was no longer of this world. I did not know that the family curse that she had carried was free to seek out and curse another Witchly. To curse me. In the early days of the Third Age of Magic, over a century and a half ago, my ancestor, Matilde Witcherly, was cursed by her magical tether, Heston Knightley. It was a powerful, hereditary curse which did not stop with Matilde, but sought out other Witchly women. One of us must always carry the curse, until our bloodline is no more.
So The Witcherlies is, I like to say, it's kind of like YA Bridgerton with magic. So it's about a young witch called Aurelia Witchley. And in this world of Regency witches, everyone comes into their magic on the full moon after their 17th birthday. So Aurelia, she goes out, she gets her magic, and unfortunately she also inherits her family curse. Which is not good for poor Aurelia, especially as, in order to keep hold of her magic, she's going to have to find another witch to tether her magic to. If she doesn't, it will just slowly disappear and she'll become magicless. And of course, as you can understand, nobody wants to tether to a witch who's been cursed. So one day she hears one of her fellow debutantes of magic, Jules Knightley, talking about how he may have found a cure for tethering. So she has to form an unlikely alliance with Jules Knightley because it was his ancestor who first cursed her ancestor, giving her the curse. It's all very complicated, but also very fancy.
Is it an alliance or a romance?
Well, it starts off as an alliance, but there is a little bit of romance shifting as we go through the story.
My family watched on. My older brother Vaughan and our mother Nell, her magical tether Frances standing close by her. They all saw it happen, saw the curse take hold. Soft grey smoke-like tendrils appeared around me, growing thicker and darker in the light from the full moon. They reached for me as I soared higher into the air, as if my magic knew what was coming and was trying to fly me to safety. But the curse smothered me. I tried to scream, but no sound came out. It was as if the tentacles of smoke had form and feeling. Small, sharp, barbed hooks drove into my skin, clinging to me, consuming me, burrowing their way into me like worms. Vaughn says that my hair turned white with shock all at once, but Mother says it was more gradual, as if the color from the once chestnut strands was pushed out by the curse. I didn't notice it, but I did feel the intense pain in my eyes as they filled with the gray mist that was becoming part of me. As my body descended, returning to the ground, I felt the power of my magic vibrating through me. The joy of having magic filled every part of me as the pain disappeared in an instant. It was as if the world had just opened, expanded with the promise of endless possibilities. But one look at my family told me that something was wrong. From that moment on, I felt betrayed by my magic. So deep and powerful, and yet so cursed. I will not get to keep it for long. Magic needs to be tethered, and no witch is going to want to join their magic to mine, to suffer the effects of my curse. My magic will leave me in a few years, and all because of a witch named Knightley.
Now, we've heard a clip of Imogen Wilde reading from the book. Were you in any way responsible for her casting?
Yeah, so I listened to a few different people and their auditions, and yeah, as soon as I heard Imogen, I was like, she's my Aurelia. Yes, she was her straight away.
And I believe you actually went to see the recording.
I did, yeah, so that was really, really special. I'd never seen my audiobooks being recorded before, but I went up to the studio and I did have a little cry when I was listening to Imogen read some of the passages.
And what about some of your other audiobooks and the narrators thereof?
One of my audiobooks in America, you can't get it unfortunately over here, was narrated by Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey, which was really lovely. And my publisher at the time, they contacted me and they were like, we might be able to get Dan, but we're not going to ask him to audition. I was like, oh, of course not. And and you need to decide today. So it was a really tough decision. And I was like, yes, immediately.
The measure of a man is what he does with power. Plato.
The villa is still and cold in the dawn, but not as cold and still as the bed next to me. I look at it, the pillow untouched, the bedsheet still tucked in. It's been 5 years since my sister last lay in the bedroom beside me, but I still catch my breath every morning. I still ready myself as I turn to face the emptiness. And this morning, this day, I feel her absence more deeply than usual. I sit up and swing my legs out of bed. The terracotta floor tiles are cool under my feet. I quickly discard my nightdress and let it fall, then cross to the chair by my dresser and pull on the tunic that's waiting for me. Our housekeeper, Ida, must have left it out while I slept. I secure my leather belt in place and quickly plait my hair, tying it with a length of leather thong.
The small clay offering jug I left on my dresser is still there, and I snatch it up in my hand. It fits perfectly, the red wax of the seal holding in the rich wine that I decanted into it before bed last night. I slip it into the fold of my tunic. My sandals have been placed under the chair, and I scoop them up as I tiptoe to the door and slip out. I cross the mosaic tiles of the hall swiftly, making my way to the front door. I'm just about to turn the handle when I hear my father call out, Ara!
The Immortal Games by Annalise Avery is narrated by Dan Stevens and Lauren Ezel in America, and the UK version is read by Laura Hanna.
What's your favourite magical creature from your books or from anywhere?
Oh, okay, so my favourite magical creatures is definitely a dragon. Like, I feel like life is better when dragons are in it, definitely. And I've got some middle grade books, so books for children aged 10 plus. They centre around a world that's like Victorian London, but highly mechanical. So it's called the Celestial Mechanism series. And in that we have dragons. When it comes to dragons, I feel like dragons should have evolved. And if dragons evolved, then they would evolve in line with most things on our planet. And therefore they would only have two legs plus wings. Because nothing evolves with four legs plus wings. Six legs I can get into. So six-legged dragons plus wings, I think that's okay. But my dragons all have two legs plus wings.
Now, you've been at Wigtown not only talking about these books, but you've also been talking about journaling as well.
Yeah, so I'm an avid journaler, and I keep my journals not just for reflection, but also for goal setting and as a kind of writing journal too. So I keep all of my projects in there. So I've been, my other workshop that I did, we were talking about how to goal set and how to think of what your ambitions are for the future, and then how to work from where we are now to where we want to be.
And we'll have more from Annalise at the end of today's show in Books of My Life. And talking about books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
The Serial Killer Next Door by Emma Kenny was donated by Little Brown.
In the still of the night, just beyond the veil of ordinary existence, there is a realm where shadows shift and what was once familiar becomes an emblem of dread. The stories we are about to embark upon are not for the faint-hearted. They delve into the most sinister enigmas of humanity, serial killers. You might want to lock your doors, but what if the danger has already seeped through your walls and into the fabric of your seemingly normal everyday existence? Every morning, as you collect the newspaper from your porch or wave to the elderly woman tending to her roses, you're living alongside a plethora of stories. Most are benign. Tales of ordinary lives, of loves lost and found, or of dreams nurtured or broken. But some tales are crafted in the darkest corners of the human psyche. These are stories that, when told, make us question our sense of safety and shatter our belief in the inherent goodness of humanity.
Would you know if you live next door to a serial killer? Emma Kenny, psychologist and true crime expert, reveals the chilling true stories of killers who hide in plain sight. Taking readers on a journey into the dark side of humanity, Emma Kenny explores the ingredient list of experiences that turns regular people into murderous monsters, looking at crimes that shook the world, from Ted Bundy to Joanna Dennehy, Richard Trenton Chase to Aileen Wuornos, and many more besides. Emma explores the crime scenes and criminal minds of some of the most notorious serial killers of our time. She also unveils shocking stories of lesser-known killers that even the most dedicated true crime fan will be surprised by. And what unites all of these killers is the ability to slip into society. They look just like you and me. Some are married, or parents, conscientious neighbours, teachers, or fixtures of their community. Join Emma in this compelling expose of their depraved world to understand what motivates them and what they look for in a victim. And then maybe you'll be able to spot the serial killer next door.
Who lives next door to you? Perhaps a friendly postman with a perennial smile, a teacher who shapes young minds, or a businessman in a sharp suit. They are faces you recognise, people you've exchanged pleasantries with, individuals as ordinary as you or me. But it's in the very depths of this ordinariness that a frightening anomaly could lurk. For within some of these seemingly normal souls lie desires so dark, they are almost impossible for the majority of us to comprehend. The allure of the serial killer in popular culture combines both fascination and repulsion. What drives a person to not only take a life, but to do it repeatedly, ritualistically, and without a shadow of remorse? To dwell on this question is to toy with a madness that lies hidden beneath the surface of civility. These aren't monstrous creatures displaying outward signs of their depravity for everyone to see. Often, these demons are indistinguishable from the rest of us. Masters of disguise, concealed behind masks of normality. Perhaps that's what terrifies us the most. It's the notion that someone you know, someone you've invited into your home, laughed with, or maybe even loved, could be leading a dual life.
The Serial Killer Next Door is written and read by Emma Kenny and runs for 9 hours.
Exit Strategy by Lee Child and Andrew Child was given to us by Penguin Random House.
Nathan Gilmore knew things that other people did not. People like his co-workers at the Port Administration in Baltimore. Things like the fact that the recent death of one of those co-workers was not an accident, despite what the police report said. It was not an accident, and the man who had died was not the intended victim. Gilmore himself was. Gilmore knew that he was the one who should have paid with his life. There was no doubt about it. And if he stayed where he was and kept on following his orders, the killers would realize they'd screwed up too. They would correct their mistake. There was no doubt about that either. So Gilmore was left with no choice. He had to pull the plug.
First, a Baltimore coffee shop. A seat in the corner facing the door. Black coffee, 2 refills, no messing around. A minor interruption from 2 of the customers, but nothing he can't deal with swiftly. As he leaves, a young guy brushes against him in the doorway. Instinctively, Reacher checks the pocket holding his cash and passport. There's no problem. Nothing is missing. Second, a store to buy a coat. Nothing fancy. Something he can ditch when he heads for warmer climes. As he pulls out his cash, he finds something new in his pocket. A handwritten note. A desperate plea for help. Third, wherever this bend in the road takes him. Impressed by the guy's technique and intrigued by the message, Reacher makes it his mission to find out more. We all need Jack Reacher, a righteous avenger for our troubled times.
Gilmore was sitting alone in the cramped office. The only other desk was lost under a heap of bouquets of flowers. Most of them were beginning to wilt. The air was heavy with their scent. Their stench, Gilmore thought. The stench of death. He began to breathe through his mouth and twisted his chair sideways to avoid the view out the window. He didn't need to see the roof of the sagging white tent. It had been put up over the center of the spot where the shipping container had hit the ground after it fell from its crane. Or was dropped. The investigators were gone, but the stain on the concrete was going to be there for months. Office gossip said the guy who had been crushed by the container wound up as flat as a piece of paper. Gilmore had known the guy for 5 months. He had shared his workspace with him, had come to like him, and ultimately had gotten him killed. He shivered and pulled a phone out of his pocket, a very basic one. He flipped it open and keyed in a message. 911, need to meet. Gilmore entered a number. He hit send, noted the time, 11:01 in the morning, and settled in to wait for a reply. There was no way he was going to get any work done that day, or any other day in that place, or in any other place, if his gambit failed. The same time Nathan Gilmore was sending his text, Jack Reacher was stepping into a coffee shop. It was a large place, bright and busy, just a stone's throw from Gilmore's dockside office. Inside, it had exposed brick walls, oak floors, and 3 parallel rows of ornate iron pillars holding up the ceiling. An old warehouse, Reacher guessed. Solid, built to endure. The kind of place that had outlasted the industry it had been designed to serve and was now onto its second lease on life. Reacher imagined that the upper floors would be converted into chic apartments as the neighborhood got gentrified, if they hadn't been already. Reacher stood in line at the counter, ordered his coffee, black, no sugar, paid, and carried the mug to a small round table in the corner. Someone had left a newspaper, but that wasn't why Reacher chose it. He settled there because it gave him a view of the whole room. He squeezed in behind the table and lowered himself onto the wooden chair. It wasn't built for someone his size, 6'5", 250 pounds, and it wasn't comfortable, but Reacher didn't mind. He wasn't planning to stay long.
Exit Strategy by Lee and Andrew Child is narrated by Jeff Harding and runs for 9 hours and 19 minutes.
We'll have more new books from Lynn in a moment, but before that, at Wigtown, I met Read On listener Charlotte Benny and Guide Dog Christie, and amongst other things, asked her about how the festival was for accessibility. But first, I asked about Charlotte's eye condition.
It's a rare one. It's something called gyrate atrophy. It's a relative of retinitis pigmentosa. I mean, until the last consultant retired at Dumfries, I used to see him once a year, and he described me as a lady with the interesting retinas. Because it was such a rare condition, he said he'd never seen anybody with it before. Mine's is more like, you know, if you're looking at an antique mirror, and it's got parts of the mirror almost like ovals and circles where the mirror just doesn't reflect. Right. That's the basically the way mine's is. And on some days I can see colours and shapes, and other days I'm just in a mist. And I don't quite know why it's like that, you know, why some days it's better than others. I've no idea. Something to do with quality of light and whether I'm tired or stressed or whatever.
So, we've met at Wigtown a number of times before. What have you been up to this year?
This year we've been at various things. We saw James Braxton again last Saturday, mainly because we'd seen him the year before and he was so interesting. We thought, well, we'll see him again. And then last Sunday, because I'd heard him being interviewed in Read On, that chap Charlie English, CIA Book Club, we went to see him, because I've already got the book in order from RNIB. And he was actually very good. And he was as good as he was when you interviewed him for Read On. And then we saw Gavin Essler. And don't ask me about Gavin Essler. That was on Sunday evening. And then on Monday, it was a ticket we'd bought just on a whim. It was tickets to see Steve Bunce, you know, the boxing commentator for the BBC. And we'd been at the boxing at Commonwealth Games last time they were in Glasgow, and that had been a grand day out, and he was an excellent speaker. He was so atmospheric that you came out thinking you'd been to Las Vegas. And of course the audience was mostly all men. There was hardly any other women there, and they were all a lot younger than me. And at the end I said to God, I said, where are they all going? They're all going to get selfies. And of course that would never occur to me. And then Wednesday evening, we always go to the Whithorn lectures, and they're usually given by the archaeologist who's worked there off and on for years, Adrian Maldonado. He's actually from New York, and he came over to do a PhD at Glasgow University, and he's now working at the National Museum of Scotland. And he's been working off and on at the excavations in Whithorn for quite a few years, and he's just produced a new guidebook. And as usual, his talks are, he's just such an excellent speaker.
What's the festival been like accessibility wise?
It's not bad, considering they're having to use tents and old buildings and such like, that we usually get seats down the front, which is quite handy. And I mean, I've known Wigtown all my life anyway, so I've still got a kind of map in my head.
Now, does Christy behave herself?
She does. She usually falls asleep. She's also been at the cinema this week. She's been to see Downton Abbey. I get emails, you know, through the year, book festival emails, and there was one to say that they were doing local writer sessions 1 hour every day from the Monday to the Friday, and if you wanted to submit stuff. And I thought, I could submit stuff, But what would be the logistics of if I have to read it out? So then we thought, well, I'll deal with that when you come to it. I thought, now, what do I send them? And because I've got fiction. But I thought, no, I won't send my fiction because lots of folk might be sending fiction. I'll send them three of what I call my diatribes. Because if things upset me or annoy me, I go and type up a piece on the laptop. And most times the next day I just delete it. I've got it out of my system, but quite a lot of them I do write them up. And I thought, right, and I've just done one on setting up a new bank card, which if you can't see is it, because bank cards now are, apart from the wee bit of braille, they're totally smooth. You know, if you lived on your own and you weren't up to date with things like seeing AI, how would you know what the numbers were? How would you know anything was in your bank card? So that, I sent them that one.
Yes, I know there is braille which identifies what type of card I am grasping. And the thumb-sized dent which, apart from helping the user shove a card into any relevant slot, also makes clear which end of a card is which. But, that's it. Long numbers, expiry date, security number. Nay chance. Because apart from the aforementioned lines of braille, a modern back card is as smooth as a banker's bahuchi. Even when raised numerals were embossed on cards, I could never read them. Braille is so much easier. Why don't banks offer the option of brailled cards to those who can use them? Since braille is now present on cards, the dots aren't going to jam up the ATM machines, are they?
And I sent one I'd done some time ago about just how bad-tempered technology can be. Because, yes, in theory it's accessible, but only when it's in a good mood. And because it was a book festival event, I also sent in a piece I'd done years ago. Basically, if guide dogs could read, what sort of books would they read and why? I did have an offer, both my husband, visibility. I've had a stand here through the week, and Stephanie had said, you know, she or Gordon, they'd both said they would prepare to read my things to the audience. And I thought, no, I want the technology to do it because that's what I use. Mm. I write with Supernova, I edit with Supernova, and I listen back to things in Supernova. Or occasionally I email them to myself and listen to them with voiceover. That, so I thought, I'll let other people hear what a screen reader's like. Mm-hmm. And we did quite a lot of testing. I had to increase the volume and I had to very much decrease the speed. And I sat and I tried to think of all the things technology could do just to play up. And I made sure I knew how to get round as many of them as possible without crying or swearing. And much to my surprise, technology behaved itself.
Now, by the time I was 3, I could read, don't know about writing, but reading had already become a favourite pastime. If I was able to master this skill when only 3, what about the higher echelons of the canine world? Especially nowadays, what with such techno-wizzes as screen readers, spell checkers, etc. In my mind's eye, I can visualize the bookshelves, just groaning under the weight of volumes. Agricultural treatises on the care of blackface yows, guides to rambling over the Galloway Hills and yomping along the Southern Upland Way, scribed by border collies. Some gory thrillers by a German shepherd interspersed with academic pieces on the development of modern police dramas on British television. Poodles, most certainly, will write fashion columns and chiclet bestsellers. And Labradors and Retrievers? Oh, their speciality would be cuisine. How to make the best use of leftovers, all of them, including fag ends squashed into the pavements and unspeakable things found in the patches of nettles up in the wood. And, perhaps, the odd political memoir?
And I got laughs where I wanted to get laughs. And quite often I could hear that, oh, noise, which tells you folk are saying to themselves, oh, I never thought about that. Because if you can see, you wouldn't. So I thought to myself, well, there's about 30 people in here. And a lot of them are going away home and they're going to look at gadgets and all sorts of things in their house and for the first time ever they're going to think, if I couldn't see, how would I work that?
Now, AI's come up quite a bit. Tell us about seeing AI.
Well, the seeing AI and there's Be My Eyes, and I always mix the two of them up. And, you know, Be My Eyes now has an AI thing built into it. You can either phone up a real person who'll give you a description of what you're looking at, or Be My Eyes has got an inbuilt AI thing, and that'll give you a description. In fact, during the summer, we were up at Kelvin Grove, and I tested it in paintings I could remember from when I could see. Mm-hmm. And the AI function in Be My Eyes read clear descriptions of these paintings to me. In fact, it even described the people who wandered in front of it.
Note to the makers of that screen reader, it's pronounced Bahookie. Thanks again to Charlotte and to Christy, who was very well behaved. Still to come, poetry and stories from Renita Boyle and Books of My Life from Annalise Avery. But before all that, let's return to the RNIB Library.
Fires That Burned Brightly by Sebastian Foulkes was donated by Penguin Random House.
In your head, you are forever young. The photo page in your passport states a fact, but it doesn't tell the truth. When some of your best friends die, however, you have at least to give a nod to the arithmetic. I never wanted to write a memoir because I didn't think my life remarkable. But at some point after the pandemic, I became aware that people of a younger generation were struggling to understand what I was saying. It was as if the stars by which I'd always steered now belonged in a different sky. The only dividend of the years vanishing, as far as I can see, is that it makes aspects of the past appear more interesting or humorous than they felt at the time. So I thought I'd put together some essays on the things that had meant the most to me, to fix in print my gratitude or pleasure. And if some of what emerged would seem quaint to younger readers, that would be part of the deal. When they'd looked at these 13 enthusiastic pieces, randomly ordered, my publishers asked me to leave out the least autobiographical and to rearrange the rest in a more chronological sequence. So, as I tried to steer away from memoir, they shunted me towards it. The result is therefore a hybrid. But we're all mongrels, I suppose, so maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Foulkes, a reluctant memoirist, offers readers a series of detailed snapshots from a life in progress. They include a post-war rural childhood, cold mutton and wet washing in a rack over the range, the booze-sodden heyday of Fleet Street, and a career as one of the country's most acclaimed novelists. There are not one but two daring escapes from boarding school, the delirium of a jet-lagged American book tour, the writing of Birdsong in his brother's house in 1992, and memorable trips across the Channel to France. Politics, psychiatry, and frustrated ventures into the world of entertainment are analysed with patience and rueful humour. The book is driven by a desire to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. It ends with a tribute to Foulkes' parents and a sense of how his own generation was shaped by the disruptive power of war and its aftermath. Sharply perceptive and alive with a generous wit, Fires Which Burn Brightly is a work of subtle yet profound intelligence and warmth.
Everything is fine. We're alive. We live in England. It's all good. From a fog, faces and words emerge. Mum, the kitchen table with a metal mincer clamped to the edge. Willie, the friendly Dalmatian with his thumping tail. A bowl of dripping. Wet washing on a rack above the range. But who we really are and what it's all about, that'll come into focus when I reach the age of 6 or 7, by which time we'll have reached the unimaginable space-age date of 1960. To start with, though, it's all about things. Hard surfaces and not falling over. Chairs and tables. The texture and smell of different woods. Marmalade on fried bread at breakfast. The awful cold mutton at lunch. As a toy, I have a farm. A piece of hardboard painted green with a blue splodge for a pond. And a balsa wood house with straw thatch that's been glued to the board. There are some plastic Frisians that could be placed at the edge of the pond. It's a present from our grandmother on Mum's side. We never meet her, though, and when we ask why, a pained look comes into Mum's eyes, and she says it's better that way. Dad's mother died of cancer in the war. Mum's father was killed by the Germans. Dad was wounded by them and they thought he'd die, but he didn't. So Edward, who was born in a local hospital in 1950, and I, who was born in 1953, in the bathroom for some reason, are part of a new project, pioneers in a landscape that's been through a bad time, but on which the sun is now set to shine. We're not rich, but we're not as poor as the people in the cottages next door. For a start, we have an indoor lav. Mum is tall and fair, Dad is handsome and has tweed jackets and striped ties. They know what they're up to.
'Fires Which Burned Brightly, A Life in Progress by Sebastian Foulkes is read by the author and runs for 8 hours and 30 minutes.
The latest in the Robert Langdon series by Dan Brown is The Secret of Secrets, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
I must have died,
the woman thought. She was drifting high above the spires of the old city. Beneath her, the illuminated towers of St. Vitus Cathedral glowed on a sea of twinkling lights. With her eyes, if she still had eyes, she traced the gentle slope of Castle Hill down into the heart of the Bohemian capital, following the labyrinth of winding streets that lay shrouded in a fresh blanket of snow.
Prague!
Disoriented, she strained to make sense of her predicament.
I am a neuroscientist, she reassured herself. I am of sound mind.
That second statement, she decided, was questionable. The only thing Dr. Brigida Gessner knew for certain at the moment was that she was suspended over her home city of Prague. Her body was not with her. She was without mass and without form, and yet the rest of her, the real her, her essence, her consciousness, seemed to be quite intact and alert, floating slowly through the air in the direction of the Vltava River. Gessner could recall nothing from her recent past except a faint memory of physical pain, but her body now seemed to consist only of the atmosphere through which she was floating. The sensation was unlike anything she had ever experienced.
Accompanying celebrated academic Catherine Solomon to a lecture she's been invited to give in Prague, Robert Langdon's world spirals out of control when she disappears without trace from their hotel room. Far from home and well out of his comfort zone, Langdon must pit his wits against forces unknown to recover the woman he loves. But Prague is an old and dangerous city, steeped in folklore and mystery. For over 2,000 years, the tides of history have washed back and forth over it, leaving behind echoes of everything that has gone before. Little can Langdon know that he is being stalked by a spectre from that dark past. He must use all of his arcane knowledge to decipher the world around him before he too is consumed by the rings of treachery and deception that have swallowed Catherine.
Against her every intellectual instinct, Gessner could find only one explanation.
I have died. This is the afterlife.
Even as the notion materialized, she rejected it as absurd.
The afterlife is a shared delusion created to make our actual life bearable.
As a physician, Gessner was intimately familiar with death, and also with its finality. In medical school, while dissecting human brains, Gessner came to understand that all those personal attributes that made us who we are, our hopes, fears, dreams, memories, were nothing but chemical compounds held in suspension by electrical charges in our brains. When a person died, the brain's power source was severed, and all of those chemicals simply dissolved into a meaningless puddle of liquid, erasing every last trace of who that person had once been.
When you die, full stop.
Now, however, as she drifted over the symmetrical gardens of Wallenstein Palace, she felt very much alive. She watched the snow falling around her, or through her. And oddly, she sensed no cold at all. It was as if her mind were simply hovering in space, with all reason and logic intact.
The Secret of Secrets, Robert Langdon, Book 6 by Dan Brown, is read by Paul Michael and lasts 22 hours and 50 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. Renita Boyle is a virtuoso of versatility, a tale-telling, tongue-twisting troubadour, poetry pixie, kidlit author, and nature-loving life writer. She is the storytelling ambassador for the Wigtown Festival Company, and she told me what stories she was telling this year.
You've been the storyteller at Wigtown for about 20 years now?
Almost. It's 18, so in 2 years it'll be my 20th year, but yes, almost two decades.
How many people do you think you've told a story to?
Well, we recently kind of worked that out. We've never taken like official records, but we reckon at least 30,000 people of all ages.
And this year you've been doing it, well, in nature. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there's I do book at bedtime like I normally do, which is at nighttime, and a story, a song, a lullaby, a poem, hot chocolate and hug out the door. But during the days, I've been doing At the Bird Hide, which is outside down on the harbour. I've been doing Wee Wings, it's called. And people come and they get a very gentle story and a gentle song and a gentle poem. And then they can make something. And this year's wee-winged creature that we've been looking at is the dragonfly. It's poetry day. And we've been thinking about dragonflies at the Bird Hide in Wigtown Book Festival. So this poem is called A Sky Samurai by Renita Boyle. That's me. Ethereal aerial acrobat, you skim the breeze, dart and pass, sky-slicing samurai of grass. Streamlined wind slayer, unsheath your iridescent arcs. Filigree wings veined with light, flawless fusion, form and flight. Gleaming armor, blue and bronze, forged in depths, reborn in dew. Bulbous helm, your mosaic eyes sweep endless skies, stalk and hunt your prey. Stealth and strike, quickened breath, burst of silence, dance of death. Your tail a katana, you are an oath in motion. Once a nymph in shadowed streams, armored, still, beneath the reeds, in murky dark, in silence cast, like all the young from ages past, breathing water, dreaming sky, you rose, O dragonfly. With fraying wings and warrior's heart, your days are few. You soul in flight, you streak of flame. Go now, guardian of reeds and rain. May sky recall your final trace, a shimmer lost you glint of grace.
Now, of those people you've told stories to, some of them must have had some sight problems.
Yes. So this morning I did some work with people with additional support needs, and it's a wonderful thing to be able to be a wordsmith.
Of course, being a storyteller doesn't involve print. It is for everyone.
It's oral. It's very much oral. I do Makaton as well with it, so quite often, just to suit whatever need there is, to try and make it as accessible to everyone as possible. I do my very best to make it multi-sensory, so quite often I will use a lot of objects and things you can touch and feel, as well as hear and see.
Now, some listeners might have noticed your accent isn't exactly from Wigtown. How did you end up here?
I married a Glaswegian, and so his name is Eric, and he's the minister at Wigtown Parish Church. And that means I'm also the minister's wife. So we met in 1983, and on our third date, 3 weeks later, we bought our engagement ring, and our 40th anniversary is actually on Sunday.
Do you have a favourite story you go back to again and again?
So from my childhood, my favourite picture book comes back to me often. It was called Petunia the Goose, and I love Petunia. I've written a kind of fun, derived version of that, but essentially the story is about a goose who thinks that she's wise because she finds a book and she tucks it under her wing, and all the animals ask for her advice, and of course she can't read, so she gives them all bad advice, calls all kinds of craziness, and then at the very end of the book they find a box with printing on it, and the box says danger fireworks, but Petunia tells them all it says chocolate. So they dive at the box and it explodes and they're all bumps and bruises, and she suddenly realizes it's not enough to have a book, you have to read it, and it's not enough to read it, you have to have the wisdom in it.
Thanks again to Renita Boyle. Petunia by Robert Duvoisin is available in audio as narrated by Diana Canova, and runs for a whole 11 minutes. For some slightly longer audiobook recommendations, let's return to Annalise Avery, author of The Witcherlies, for The Books of My Life.
Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Yeah, so when I was a kid, I really liked reading non-fiction. So I'd read lots and lots of non-fiction. And it wasn't actually until I went to high school that I started getting into reading novels. And I had an English teacher, Mr. Devery, and I think he took one little look at me and was like, Annalise is a special little nerd. I know exactly which book she'll like. And he gave me a copy of The Hobbit. And that was like the moment when I read a book and I was like, oh my goodness, you know, these are the worlds that I could find in books. And so that was like the book that made me into a reader and a writer and a much better person.
In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. Not a nasty, dirty, wet hole filled with the ends of worms and an oozy smell, nor yet a dry, bare, sandy hole with nothing in it to sit down on or to eat. It was a hobbit hole, and that means comfort. It had a perfectly round door like a porthole, painted green, with a shiny yellow brass knob in the exact middle. The door opened onto a tube-shaped hall like a tunnel, a very comfortable tunnel without smoke, with panelled walls and floors tiled and carpeted, provided with polished chairs and lots of pegs for hats and coats. The hobbit was fond of visitors. The tunnel wound on and on, going fairly but not quite straight into the side of the hill. The hill, as all the people for many miles round called it, and many little round doors opened out of it, first on one side and then on another. No going upstairs for the hobbit. Bedrooms, bathrooms, cellars, pantries, lots of these. Wardrobes. He had whole rooms devoted to clothes. Kitchens, dining rooms, all were on the same floor, and indeed on the same passage. The best rooms were all on the left-hand side going in, for these were the only ones to have windows, deep-set, round windows looking over his garden and meadows beyond, sloping down to the river. This hobbit was a very well-to-do hobbit, and his name was Baggins. The Bagginses had lived in the neighbourhood of the hill for time out of mind, and people considered them very respectable. Not only because most of them were rich, but also because they never had any adventures or did anything unexpected. You could tell what a Baggins would say on any question without the bother of asking him. This is a story of how a Baggins had an adventure and found himself doing and saying things altogether unexpected. He may have lost the neighbour's respect, but he gained, well, you will see whether he gained anything in the end.
Andy Serkis reading from The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien, which is available from RNIB Library. It's also available as an audio drama and in Braille.
And is there a book on a rainy day you can happily curl up with and reread?
So I've got a couple of books that I really like rereading and re-going back to. But I think probably my favourite is Terry Pratchett's Tiffany Aching series. So if you love Terry Pratchett and you haven't read Tiffany Aching because you think that those ones are for kids, they're for you too. They're brilliant. They're so good. And everything that you expect from Terry.
Some things start before other things. It was a summer shower but didn't appear to know it, and it was pouring rain as fast as a winter storm. Miss Perspicacia Tick sat in what little shelter a raggedy hedge could give her and explored the universe. She didn't notice the rain, witches dried out quickly. The exploring of the universe was being done with a couple of twigs tied together with string, a stone with a hole in it, an egg, one of Miss Tick's stockings, which also had a hole in it, a pin, a piece of paper, and a tiny stub of pencil. Unlike wizards, witches learn to make do with a little. The items had been tied and twisted together to make a device. It moved oddly when she prodded it. One of the sticks seemed to pass right through the egg, for example, and came out the other side without leaving a mark. "Yes," she said quietly, as rain poured off the rim of her hat. "There it is. A definite ripple in the walls of the world. Very worrying. There's probably another world making contact. That's never good. I ought to go there, but, according to my left elbow, there's a witch there already." "She'll sort it out then," said a small and, for now, mysterious voice from somewhere near her feet. "No, it can't be right. That's chalk country over that way," said Miss Tick. "You can't grow a good witch on chalk. The stuff's barely harder than clay. You need good hard rock to grow a witch, believe me." Miss Tick shook her head, sending raindrops flying. "But my elbows are generally very reliable." "People say things like listen to your heart, but witches learn to listen to other things too. It's amazing what your kidneys can tell you." "Why talk about it? Let's go and see," said the voice. "We're not doing very well around here, are we?" That was true. The lowlands weren't good to witches. Miss Tick was making pennies by doing bits of medicine and misfortune-telling. "Ordinary fortune-tellers tell you what you want to happen. Witches tell you what's going to happen, whether you want it to or not. Strangely enough, witches tend to be more accurate but less popular." "And slept in barns most nights. She'd twice been thrown in ponds." "I can't barge in," she said. "Not on another witch's territory. That never, ever works. But," she paused, "witches don't just turn up out of nowhere. Let's have a look." She pulled a cracked saucer out of her pocket and tipped into it the rainwater that had collected on her hat. Then she took a bottle of ink out of another pocket and poured in just enough to turn the water black. She cupped it in her hands to keep the raindrops out and listened to her eyes.
Stephen Briggs reading from The Wee Free Men by Terry Pratchett, book one of the Tiffany Aching series and one of the many, many Terry Pratchett books in the RNIB library.
And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book. Something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
Yeah, so I'm currently reading The Spell Shop. I'm actually listening to it on audio. And it's by Sarah Beth Durst. And it's really good. It's a fantasy fiction. It's about a witch who works in a library. And the city that she works in, there's been a revolution. And people have come to storm the library. So she's escaped with some spell books to an island that she used to live on when she was little. And everything has changed. And she has changed. But maybe she can help the people that she used to live with.
Keela never thought the flames would reach the library. She was dimly aware that most of the other librarians had fled weeks ago, when the revolutionaries took the palace and defenestrated the emperor in a rather dramatic display. But surely they wouldn't touch the library. After all, there were books here. Highly flammable, irreplaceable books. The Great Library of Elysium, with its soaring spires, stained glass windows, and labyrinthine bookshelves, was the jewel of the Crescent Islands Empire. Its hallowed stacks were filled with centuries-old treatises, histories, studies, and, most importantly, in Keela's opinion, spellbooks. Only the elite, the creme de la creme of the scholars, were allowed to even view the spellbooks, as only the rarefied few were permitted, by imperial law, to use magic. She was responsible for the spellbooks on the third floor, East Wing. For the past 11 years, she'd worked, slept, ate, and lived between the shelves, which perhaps explained why, when she first smelled smoke, she thought she'd simply left toast on the cook plate.
The Spell Shop by Sarah Beth Durst is read by Caitlin Davis and is available commercially.
That's all we've got time for on today's Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not dig into the back catalogue of Read On? There's over 450 episodes available online, featuring authors such as Bill Bryson, Sam Harvey, Lucy Worsley, John le Carré, Michael Bond, and even Spike Milligan. Just search for RNIB Read On and it should be the first result. For everything else, including our sister show, Talking Books, just search for RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.